The words from Matthew 7, which say, "In everything, do to others that you would have them do to you," have become so familiar to us that we may not really have thought about them for a long time. They are commonly called the Golden Rule. It's interesting to note that these words, in some form or other, often with negative wording, are included in the text of most other religions and philosophies. The Baha'i Faith, Buddhism, Confucianism, Hinduism, Islam, Jainism, Judaism, Sikhism, Taoism, Zoroastrianism. If they are so important, it makes me wonder why there is so little notice taken of them in everyday life. Why have there been and still are so many conflicts with religious connotations around the world? Have none of them ever remembered these words? Most of us can remember the fierce and dreadful conflicts between Catholics and Protestants in Ireland during our lifetime and the heartache and bloodshed they caused. We see the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine, in Myanmar, in Asia. We remember what happened in Bosnia with over 8,000 unarmed Muslims killed by the Serbian military forces. During this conflict, Muslims seemed to pay the highest price. When the massacre began in different cities of Bosnia, it was clear that the aim was to cleanse the country of the Muslim population. After years of bitter fighting between Bosnian Muslims, Serbians and Croats, Western countries stepped in, backed by NATO, and imposed a final ceasefire. The final death toll was 102,000. Similarly, in the Sudan, complex ethnic, racial and religious conflict arose, in which the Muslim regime committed genocide against Christians in the south of the country. For more than two decades, the Sudanese government has waged war against the Christians in the state, and so the conflicts continue. We've seen that revenge seems to be dominant, taking whatever path the participants can find to settle their differences. The Golden Rule is certainly not at work in these conflicts. Even though the words are few, they have such significance that the Judaic interpretation of them says, "What is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbour. This is the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Go and learn it." Simple but profound. But who is taking any notice of it? How would I react if my life was threatened, my city bombed, my loved ones killed, my neighbours and friends alienated, all in the name of religion? I think we see ourselves as a very accepting country, where we can live side by side comfortably with those of other cultures and religions. But I think back to the early 1990s, when for several years I spoke at community groups on behalf of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which grants wishes to children with life-threatening illnesses. One of my engagements was at Mount Scopus Jewish School in Burwood, next door to what is now Deakin University. Back in the 1950s, it was Burwood Teachers College where I trained as a teacher. Then we shared sporting facilities with the school. There were no fences between the properties. But when I returned in the 1990s, I was shocked to find that I needed a security pass to get into the property. There was a uniformed guard in the very narrow entrance cubicle, and the school was surrounded by hugely high cyclone fencing. I spoke at two assemblies with 1,000 students at each assembly. I felt as if I were in another world. We know that the Jewish community and several of its individual members have been attacked on many occasions, as have Muslims and other religious communities. I wonder how I would feel if I was on constant lookout for those who might attack our church and its members. At a church level, we know some have left our congregation because of hurtful things said to them. Others have come to us for the same reason. It can be triggered by things which seem so unimportant in the whole scheme of things. Just because we all worship the same God doesn't mean we all necessarily have a lot in common with each other. Conflict can arise with theological differences, to matters pertaining to the running of the church, finance, decisions regarding new pastoral staff, the use of the building and its maintenance, the structure of worship services, church events, and so on. any of these can be at the heart of disagreements. Do we always support our pastor, deacons, and administrative staff? If we feel the need to criticise, do we approach the issue with care and sensitivity, or do we rush in where angels fear to tread, so to speak? Is everyone welcome, even if they aren't like us? I remember several years ago, after attending a service in a city church, we were all making our way to another building for morning tea. A man was sitting on the step. He'd been wandering round the sanctuary during the service, but he hadn't been at all disruptive. I asked him if he would like a cup of tea. After leaving him, I mentioned to a deacon that he may need some help. As the deacon ate his piece of cake, he said not to bother about him. He often came around and was a bit of a nuisance. I was quite distressed that there was no more concern for him. This man seemed to have been put in the too hard basket. And it seems to me that we are doing that to our Aboriginal community. There's been so much in the press recently about young Aboriginal people in custody and the tragic death of Veronica Nelson. How long will these tragedies continue to occur? Obviously, some staff couldn't care less about the welfare of these people. How would I feel if I was rejected and didn't fit in because I didn't fit in? Maybe because I looked different, or because I had differences of opinion, or because I had mental health issues. A recent press article outlined how Indigenous and other vulnerable teenagers are being locked alone in their cells for up to 22 hours a day amid a crisis in Victoria's biggest juvenile justice facility. Whistleblowers have raised concerns about the use of isolation. One teacher resigned, claiming that boys were threatening to kill themselves just so they could have some human contact with the person keeping them under constant surveillance. Someone at the door to talk to. Many of them are still on remand. They haven't even been charged with anything. Where is the care and compassion that these people need? How would I feel if I spent most of each day in isolation in a small cell with little or no human contact? Joe Buchanan, who had volunteered in the prison system, wrote this letter to The Age. For 5 years, I worked voluntarily once a week in Sydney's Mollewa Maximum Security Women's Prison, teaching the inmates meditation and physical relaxation. Those who attended loved being able to find ways to help alleviate their constant stress. But every week, once it was time to meditate and the group had settled into a calm and peaceful silence, the prison warders would barge into the room, yelling and laughing at us, deliberately ruining the experience. Buchanan continued, "Although I complained to the authorities, nothing was done to stop this happening, and each week when I arrived, the warders would laugh and say, 'Look out, here comes the medication teacher.' However, despite the constant setbacks, the group members persevered and many positive results were achieved despite the cruelty of the prison warders." Here was Jo Buchanan reaching out to the prisoners while the prison warders were trying to destroy her work. One might ask what the process was in employing these people. How would I feel if every chance I took for rehabilitation was sabotaged? We've had the opportunity in recent months to hear voices from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities as we move towards the possibility of giving them a voice in Parliament. As we know, even they all don't agree. We've heard some very strident voices, as well as those who are calmly and quietly putting the case for the yes vote. Whether we decide to vote yes or no in the upcoming referendum, we need to try and put ourselves in the shoes of these people and endeavour to understand why some voices are so strident. We need to remember that our Indigenous communities have been dispossessed with their unique lifestyle upended, their means of collecting food destroyed, their culture not recognised by white settlers, their languages, traditions and care of the environment not acceptable. They were not even recognised as human beings by some when the first settlers arrived, as the land was declared terra nullius. Before white people landed in Australia, everyone in the Indigenous communities experienced strong bonds of belonging. a sense of place where everyone was engaged in activities, embracing strong bonds of tradition, including dance, song, and storytelling. Everyone had a role to play in hunting for and gathering food, preparing it, making tools and implements for general use, participating in rituals, and so on. After the first fleet landed, they also had to cope with the introduction of infectious diseases and the easily obtained alcohol, which they used to deaden the pain of their dispossession. And it was only after the referendum on May 27, 1967, that they were even given a vote. We know that various governments have poured millions of dollars into helping these people, but were they asked what they really needed? Were they really consulted? When my son Richard was studying at uni, he worked in a group which chose to study an Aboriginal community in Mildura. They spent several days living and talking with these people. At that particular time, one thing which was predominant in the minds of these Indigenous people was their accommodation. The government had built a few large homes for this community, but large buildings were not what they wanted. They would have preferred to have several smaller homes, but their needs were not even considered. One young boy, about 11 years old, was very engaged in the discussion with the students. They asked him what he would like to do when he left school. He stood proudly and said he wanted to become a policeman to help his people. Of course, housing was only one facet of their needs. We also need to think about their access to health care and education, and their need for us to listen to what they have to say, to understand their background. In deciding how we will vote in the referendum, we need to be as informed as possible. One positive voice from the Liberal Party is the former Deputy Leader Fred Chaney, a prominent advocate for reconciliation, who stood alongside Labor Senator and Special Envoy for Reconciliation, Patrick Dodson, at a forum back in March to call for national unity. Chaney said the voice presented the chance for Australians to show to themselves and the world that they could establish a new relationship between white and Indigenous people. With clean hearts, clean spirits, and potentially clean hands. He said, "This is going to be one of the best things we're ever going to have the chance to vote on. If we say yes, it will be one of the most liberating things. It will be free. It will free everyone from guilt and shame and embarrassment." He said it would show the world that Australia was prepared to recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the Constitution and give them the capacity to make representations to the Parliament and executive government. Many people are against it, some because it doesn't seem to be going far enough, but surely a small step is better than no step. Another Indigenous man, Daniel Morrison, praised the Prime Minister for his speech a few weeks ago. In clarifying the words of the voice, he said, "To see the care and compassion the Prime Minister spoke with at his press conference about unity, about walking alongside our mob in genuine partnership, inspires a great amount of hope. This vote means something not only to me and my family, but to all of us across the country." In our Lenten study centred around the Lord's Prayer, Safina Stewart, the daughter-in-law of our former minister, a Torres Strait Islander, said that the needs of Indigenous people must be met and injustices mended. There's so much pain still there. So in our personal deliberations, we must ensure that we are all well informed, do our homework, and in doing so, ask ourselves, how would we feel if our land had been taken over by strangers who spoke a different language and ate strange food, who isolated us from our local communities, often removing us from our family group or even from our parents' care because they were not seen as suitable guardians, then placing us in foster care or in missions run by well-meaning missionaries who didn't always understand our culture and way of life but expected us to accept theirs? Wouldn't we like to have some say over our future? We need to keep looking at that verse in Matthew. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Try to understand their anger and frustration and don't ignore their history. Another group which isn't widely supported is the LGBTQ community. They're often vilified by many in the general population, as well as experiencing rejection even by their own families. One member of the community commented at some time, "There's so much heartache in the way we're treated by so many people. No one would choose this way of life. It's how we were born." And some sections of the church have made things even worse by using aversion therapy for a so-called cure. Imagine being told that you are damaged goods, an abomination in the sight of God, and need to change to be accepted in the church. Do to others. Even now, many will not reveal who they really are, fearing ridicule or aggression. How would I feel if I had been born that way and had to pretend I was not, to avoid having to cope with abuse, condemnation, ridicule, and alienation? There are so many Bible passages which address the way we treat others. Galatians 3:28 reads, "You are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ, for all of you were baptized into Christ, have clothed yourself with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." And that new commandment given by Jesus, the version in Matthew 22 reading, "Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, 'Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law?' Jesus replied, 'Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbour as yourself. All the law and prophets hang on these two commandments.'" Time and again, Jesus challenged the people to care for one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated ourselves, to focus on how we behave and live in our daily lives. Many of us continue to be concerned about the treatment of our refugees by our government. In past years, a former Prime Minister said, "None of these people who have arrived by boat at our shores will ever become Australian citizens." So people who have been proven to be genuine refugees have languished in indefinite detention. Many of them fled from their countries out of fear for their lives, often leaving without documentation or means of identification. Many of them have lost any hope of a good life in this country. Some have self-harmed in desperation. How would we feel if we were still in detention, with no positive outlook for the future, no chance of working, no chance of living in the community, knowing that we had fled from our country in fear, only to have that fear enforced by a so-called friendly country, perhaps indefinitely? We've just revisited the journey Jesus took from that joyful journey to Jerusalem, followed by the Last Supper in the upper room, through to his betrayal, his trial, his conviction, and his crucifixion. We've heard again how the crowd who gathered before Jesus was sentenced, surely having heard Jesus' teachings of love, justice, and compassion, were swayed by the mob and allowed themselves to be caught up in the frenzy as they yelled, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" We've remembered the dignity of Jesus as he suffered unimaginable pain and humiliation when he was nailed to the cross and left to die. The guard who pierced Jesus' side went that extra step towards giving him an extra punishment. Jesus' words, "Do to others as you would have them do to you," seemed to come from a different world. If we'd been part of that crowd, how would we have felt when we reached home and thought about what had happened and the role we had played? Let us look within ourselves and ask, "Do I always do to others what I would like them to do to me?" Amen.